I'd like to call to order this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this fine September 30th day of 2015. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning.
The first order of business we have is to adopt the proposed rules for the 78th Legislative Assembly interim session. Mr. Vice Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the rules as presented to the committee, dated September 30th, 2015.
It's been moved by Representative Davis that we adopt the proposed rules for the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Do I see any objection? Any comment? The rules are adopted. Mr. Brennan has been kind enough to bring to us today a summary of legislation that is now available from the 2015 session. You'll see a copy at your dais. There is also a link here that I think has a more in-depth report of what came out of this committee in the last session, so please feel free to avail yourself of that. And please thank you, Mr. Brennan, and the staff up in your office for putting this together for all of us and making that available to us. I wanted to say briefly that we had a very robust schedule prepared for this particular transportation committee, and unfortunately, one of our key presenters for our I've lost the title of what we had on here.
Madam Chair, it was an update on the Trade and Logistics Initiative.
The Trade and Logistics Initiative that came out of Oregon Business and the Port of Portland after their round robin of meetings this past summer. One of the key presenters had a death in the family, and we excused him and allowed him to be absent today, and that put us in a position to just take that whole piece of the agenda and move it to November. It made more sense to us to keep all of the agency reports, the Port of Portland's piece, OBDD, and Mr. Friedman's piece all intact, so that has all been moved. So we do have an abbreviated agenda today, and we'll be very interested in hearing from Mr. Mather on elements of the Oregon Resiliency Plan, on what's going on in major transportation construction projects. So, Mr. Mather, I'm going to turn it over to you, sir, and I appreciate greatly your being here today. And I believe we're going to start with the construction projects update, if I'm not mistaken. Welcome to our committee. Facing the wrong direction. It's very odd. It's very odd what's happening here.
It's more odd than what it should be.
We will survive our trip over to the dark side here, but we welcome you.
Good morning. Madam Chair, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, kind of walk you through kind of what's been going on this summer for ODOT and our major projects. I'll just start by saying it's been a very successful summer for us with our projects. You'll hear me say in many of these projects we are ahead of schedule or on schedule. We were on budget or under budget. I'll point out a couple of exceptions to that, but from a program level, it's been a very successful summer for ODOT and its contractors in building some very major projects for the state. I'm going to start kind of my tour around the state in Klamath County. With the Highway 140 project. On my title slide here is actually a good picture of that project. It's a over Bly Mountain, a piece of highway that's been kind of left behind for many years because of the challenges going over Bly Mountain. We have truck restrictions on that roadway. Here's where it's located at. It's between Klamath Falls and Lakeview. Truck restrictions, so there's length limits for trucks that travel between those two communities on that route. And with this project, we will eliminate those restrictions and allow a more free flow of freight traffic in that area. A very significant project. It is a $31 million project. Half of those funds are coming from the Jobs and Transportation Act that was passed here in 2009. The contractor is K&E Excavation out of Salem. They have completed from the summit to the east. They just opened a few weeks ago. Next season they will complete from the summit back to the west and have a ribbon cutting in this project. I was out there earlier this summer, or in August, and you can imagine going through in trying to rebuild this, there's quite a complex flagging operation that has to take place to allow the work to happen and traffic continue to flow in here. And there were some fairly lengthy delays. In talking to some of the motorists out there, they were very happy to be delayed and could see the progress that K&E was making and how fast the project was coming together, and a long-awaited improvement to the highway that they were anxious to see complete. Here's a piece of the completed section that I was talking about.
So, Paul, when did the project start, and what was the anticipated completion date then versus now?
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, the project started last summer, so summer of 15, about midway through the summer. I think in one of my reports I was showing some of the culvert work, some of the base work that they were doing, but really didn't start in earnest until the spring. So the project's on schedule, on budget, going very well.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Paul. Did I hear you say you found a way to make drivers enjoy traffic delays?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And is that possible to reproduce in every major construction project around the state?
I think that, Madam Chair, Representative Davis, I think the key is just the importance of the project and having our contractors out there working very diligently. And K&E is a great contractor that moves projects very quickly. And the motorists appreciate seeing the work and knowing that while they wait in frustration, there's a benefit on the other end of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Mather, how many miles is that project? What length is the...
Madam Chair, it's about 9 miles long. I may have that a little off, but it's a fairly lengthy project that goes up and over Bly Mountain.
I've been over there a few times. That'll be a welcome change.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, Representative...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what's the cost? How much money?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, it's a $31 million project. About half of those funds are coming from Jobs and Transportation Act. The other are federal funds.
So is the follow-up?
Yes.
And the other half is coming from?
Federal funds.
Federal funds.
Yeah, I think it's the Federal Land Access Program.
And final follow-up, is the project then complete, or is there still more to do? It seems to me there was another issue down there, but I'm not from there, so I don't
know. Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, Highway 140 has many challenges on 140. This particular project will eliminate the length restriction between Klamath Falls and Lakeview, going further east from Lakeview on into Nevada and eventually on down to Winnemucca. There are other length restrictions that are other challenges. So probably what you remember, you're recalling of conversations about projects and needs on the east side of Lakeview.
Right. Thank you.
Questions?
That would be my district, the east side
it
of Lakeview.
Is.
I just want to point that out.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No wonder it was left out.
No surprise there, Representative Bentz. Who represents everything.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Mather. Please continue.
So I-84 at Highway 97, two major freight routes in this corridor where they intersect at Biggs Junction, has been a project that I've talked about improvements to that. That project is now complete, came in on schedule and under budget. It's a nice improvement to that intersection. Kerr Contractors was the contractor on the $22 million project. 19 of that came from the Jobs and Transportation Act and facilitates the movement of freight traffic. So one of the things that we're talking about with the local Area Commission on Transportation is shown here on this picture. See if my cursor works here. Up here on the upper right corner, some of the savings in the project, we're looking at extending that climbing lane on up that grade to help freight traffic up there. So we're applying that the savings on this project to further facilitate freight movement here. Had a nice ribbon cutting event for it last June on the project. In this photograph, there's actually a piece of trivia for you. Behind the presenters, there's the first traffic signal in Sherman County. So it's taken until 2015 before Sherman County got their first traffic signal.
Wow.
Here's a nice picture of
that
just
a momentous occasion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Much to celebrate on this project. Yeah. So nice looking project. You see the finished product and what it looks like going underneath the freeway there. Next one, talking about in Troutdale. This is improvements to the Troutdale interchange, or the 257th interchange there. This project will be wrapping up this fall. And you see the improvements that we're making there, where Marine Drive comes in. Today, if you, and I'm sure Representative Gorsuch is aware of this and many others too, if you want to head north of the interstate and you're coming from Portland or you're headed to the east and you get off here, you have to go further to the intersection that's not shown in this picture, further to the bottom, and loop back around before you come. With this project, we're widening that structure, and so when you immediately come off the freeway, you're able to make that left turn and head directly to Marine Drive to support the industrial area that the port is developing. FedEx is out there, a very important economic hub for the region. This will be a nice project to facilitate that growth in that area.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to continue to see the one-way grid, though, on either side, where, you know, the north side is a westbound and then the south side is an eastbound? So will there be
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, yes. The configuration of the interstate will basically stay the same.
Okay.
It's just that major movement coming from Portland,
right,
headed out towards Marine Drive and Industrial, that won't have to take that longer route. It'll be able to make that immediate left, and then obviously coming back, headed back towards Portland, you have that right turn to get right back on the freeway.
Is the other underpass part of a future sort of situation? Because, you know, you did the bridge, which was awesome, over the Sandy River. So I was just wondering about that.
Madam Chair, I smile just because I got this exact same question in the Senate yesterday.
Ah.
And we're having those conversations almost as we speak,
okay,
because we have savings also identified on this project, and we're talking about the feasibility of replacing that structure and improving that side of the interchange as well. So that's still an active conversation.
Okay.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I drive through this all the time, and it's been impressive to see again, just like on the 140 project, just how quickly this has all happened. This is going to, I think, really help a lot, especially for the airport, FedEx, all of that. And now they're doing a lot more land preparation around FedEx, so I'm sure there's more to come out there.
There is, Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch. Hamilton Construction is a contractor and has been doing an excellent job. Great to work with on this project.
Great.
Thank you.
Sunrise Corridor is one I've talked about, another major project in a major economic kind of hub of the Portland region. I've shown this slide several times. This is the connection from the Milwaukee Expressway moving through that industrial area on out 224 122nd, make sure I got my numbers right, 122nd Avenue. I just want to show this. I'm going to show in the next slide kind of how this interchange here at 205 works. The structure that you've seen being built over 205 is actually a connection from 82nd Avenue to 82nd Drive. So it's this connection I got my cursor on right here. The existing structure will actually be what will carry the Milwaukee Expressway extension that will connect into the new alignment that we're building. And we opened up that new connection just recently, and here you'll see a picture of that. So here's that new cursor working. Here's that new structure that carries the 82nd Avenue to 82nd Drive. So that's been disconnected here, and the new Milwaukee Expressway will connect in the existing structure, and then you see the new alignment starting to take off here. You also see many of the bike ped facilities we have with the I-205 multi-use path in that area. So it's starting to take shape in that interchange. Here's a shot of the dual alignment. We have some paving work to do next spring, but this should be open to traffic sometime early next construction season. And again, this is another project that's on schedule and under budget.
And Paul, yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for you about the area east of all of this. So anybody who drives through this area knows just how congested it has been, especially if you're getting off at 224, 212 and going east. So I'm sure this will help. The Fred Meyer complex is out there and a number of other industrial and warehouse. What, if any, is the plan for out through Damascus and up to Highway 26? Do we know what the status of that corridor is right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, this is phase one of the Sunrise Corridor project. The actual environmental assessment or environmental impact statement actually covered improvements on beyond the Rock Creek Junction towards Damascus.
Okay.
And so future phases, when funding is available, we would continue to build and improve that area.
I think, if I follow up, that I think would be a tremendous benefit also to East Multnomah County, because what happens right now is that all the traffic coming in from Highway 26, which, you know, 26 kind of evaporates right there by Fred Meyer and Gresham.
Right.
And it seems as if the key thing is to just move all that traffic through East County neighborhoods, with the priority being to this north-south traffic. So I'm really pleased to see that we're doing more things to enhance the ability to take 26 and then down through 212, 224, and then over to Milwaukee, because right now it's a pretty bad 257th, which I drive a lot at rush hour times. It can be very difficult to even get out on those roads. Right. So I'm very pleased to see that we're working.
But just to be clear, with our current funding, the project we have here is all we have funding for construction. Right. To go in those future phases, we'll need additional construction dollars.
Okay.
Mr. Mather, where in the planning phase would or phase two be then in your shop?
Madam Chair, it's been through the environmental process. We would start the right-of-way process. In fact, some of the savings that we have on this project we're contemplating working with Clackamas County is that's an option, is do some proactive buying of property in strategic locations. And there's some other things we're thinking about with some of the savings in the project. But the next step in those other phases would be to purchase right-of-way and then construct other phases. But the environmental piece of the project is complete.
But there are things that you can begin to do to keep that moving forward.
Yep.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Vince.
No, Chair. So, Paul, the question that I've asked repeatedly over the years has been how we communicate to the folks that use these roads the value of this type of infrastructure expense. And other than being able to get through it more quickly and putting the sign up that says your tax dollars at work, is there something else? Because this is to make it actually work, we have to do more.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will say, well, let's just give up. It's hopeless. We're never going to get ahead of this thing. So this is all what? Get a drone, a bicycle. I don't know what the alternative is, but how do we measure the improvement that we're seeing right here and then communicate it to those that use these systems?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, if you go on the website for this project, we have quite a discussion about the hour delays, particularly the hours of delays for Fred Meyer, Safeway, other major retailers in this area. I can't cite the number off the top of my head, but it's a very, very large number. And so we measure those type of things and report out on what the current is and what will be saved with this phase of the project and what will be saved with other phases of the project. Clearly, that's information as policymakers and decision makers that it's valuable as we prioritize needs in the region. And it's also useful in communicating to the public the value of projects such as this.
Oh, but we could have our legislators tweet or something, boy, am I going fast, or something to get it. I'm
not tweeting while they're driving,
well,
I'm sure.
Well, no.
Well, at least
pulling
fast.
Over.
I was going fast. Okay, well, anyway, there's got to be some way, because without that link, that direct, you know, the direct.
Yeah, I think what you'll see us do this spring as this project comes to ready to be open to traffic, we will have quite several events highlighting the value of the project and what it means to the region. Obviously, there'll be a big media draw, and we'll make a splash about the project and the value that it has, not only to the local area, but also the entire region.
Thank you.
So would phase two in your planning process be part of your planning with, you know, your financial resources being what they are right now? And how do we, I'm trying to think of the messaging that Representative Bence brought up about a phase two implementation under the current budgetary constraints that we face, or with the potential of an influx through a transportation package and what that could do. Is there a possibility to quantify what that would be and what the benefit would be to congestion in the area?
Madam Chair, yes. I mean, financially where we're at is there, after we're done with this phase and maybe some savings applied to proactive right-of-way purchasing, we're done in this corridor. So it's going to take a new infusion of money. There's not
enough. Phase two is contingent upon.
Yeah, there's not enough federal funds or state funds that that we'd prioritize towards a major improvement such as this. We've, as you've heard me talk about before, our needs in pavements and bridges and culverts and everything else, that's where the majority of our funds are going to. Our commission just went through a prioritization process to start our next STIP update, our next capital improvement update, and they prioritize those maintenance things that I just described as very, very high in their prioritization. And we'll have a few kind of improvements, operational improvements to the system, but nowhere near the magnitude of what it would take to do phase two such as this.
Okay. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So kind of going off then into hypothetical land, has there been a consideration of then taking the Milwaukee Expressway corridor and doing what they did years ago on 217, where you take surface intersections and do away with those and put you know, the normal kind of access and all of that, with where you wouldn't have the traffic having to stop for these various intersections. Would that be a possible consideration so that you could also improve that flow down to McLaughlin?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, those are things we think about in the planning process and consider with needs. As we talk with Clackamas County and other people in the region, I-205 is a major focus area for them. I-205, particularly between the Stafford Road interchange and the Oregon City, where we have two lanes, three lanes. So there's other priorities, whether it's phase two of this or improvements on 205, some of the auxiliary lanes. We have other opportunities there to improve the efficiencies of 205. Some of those seem to stack up higher in priority, but obviously we think about those kind of improvements to the Milwaukee Expressway as well.
One of the problems, though, I think, in terms of Oregon City West Lynn is the bridge itself, isn't it? I mean, it seemed, because I drive that all the time, but it seems like the bridge is really set up for that two-lane configuration through that section. Would you have to do a new bridge or add on to what's there? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Garcia, those are things that we're looking at. Okay. Likely, given the nature of that bridge, we'd be able to widen that bridge. The interchanges on either side, the ramps, the shortness of those ramps, there's a number of operational issues that cause that congestion there besides just the number of lanes. So there's several things we'd have to do to improve in that bridge and interchange area.
And one last follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
To talk about what Representative Bentz was talking about, one of the things that I think we can make a point of in terms of the changes in the Portland metropolitan area is that we're asking Interstate 205 and Interstate 84, which have been, you know, 205 came online in the early 80s, 84 was widened with the blue line in about 85. We're asking that infrastructure to carry tremendous growth, both into Clackamas County and out into eastern sections of Multnomah County. So I think talking about the need to create other pieces like this that make it move more smoothly, I think, is an important aspect of that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Paul, if in past projects such as the CRC and others, there was an attempt to quantify the return on the investment of a transportation dollar such as we're looking at here, and the value that gave back to the community. And you mentioned freight and the time it takes for commuting. Is there a way of saying to people, if you were to spend a dollar on these roads, it would save this much or gain that much, depending upon the size side of the equation? I know we've done this because we got the numbers back on the CRC, and over time it would have created $3 billion in excess of the cost. Over 10 years or something. Have we done that here? And can we say to people, if you pay another dollar in gasoline tax, you are going to save this much in commute time and you're going to gain this much in lower grocery prices?
Madam Chair, Representative, we haven't said it exactly that way. We have done studies, like I've talked about in this area, of the amount of delay for freight or the improvement of free flow for traffic and how operations, but we haven't gone and said you pay a dollar here and it equals this there. I'm not aware of it. Can we do that? Yes, we can. You can make those kind of studies based on assumptions and claims the way way you'd want to kind of market or to show the value of those kind of improvements.
Follow up.
Quantify those values. Yeah.
So we're having this debate when it comes to CO2 and carbon. We're suggesting rather than invest willy-nilly in carbon reduction technology, we ought to have a cost-benefit analysis and what the true return is to those paying those prices. Mm-hmm. We must be doing the same thing when it comes to gasoline tax and this type of infrastructure investment. We should be,
right.
I think we are, but I'm just not sure it's reflected in a way that maybe resonates as strongly or as powerfully as it might with those that we're going to be asking to pay for more of this type of investment. So I would just
Representative, we talk from a cost-benefit standpoint, how much a certain piece of project or infrastructure improvement costs versus the benefit, and you quantify those benefits a number of different ways. We think about it in those terms, not necessarily a gas tax increase. We don't take it the next step. We just think in terms of kind of a cost-benefit of any particular project and how it stacks up against another project.
So for purposes of what we anticipate will be a transportation package a year and a half from now, knowing how to explain to those who would have to support it the benefit that inures to them by virtue of paying more at the pump, mm-hmm. that type of number would or analysis would be very helpful. And if you already have it, I just need it. If you don't have it, then we probably should work on it.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and see what we have off the top of my head. I'd be afraid to answer that question right here, but we'll go back and see what we got.
Sure. Thank you.
You may have the benefit of time, Representative Benz. Thank you, Mr. Mather. Please continue.
Okay. Newburgh-Dundee Bypass is the next project I want to talk about, another major project that I've talked about a number of times here. And like the Sunrise Corridor, it is a segment of a much larger project that we've gone through the EIS process with. Based on funding from the Jobs and Transportation Act, we took that very large need down to what we're calling Phase 1, which goes from just outside of Dundee there on the left of the screen to the right of the screen down Springbrook to 99, essentially providing a relief or a bypass of Newburgh and Dundee downtown areas that if you've ever been there on a Friday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, or really any afternoon, it's a very, very congested, area. Currently under construction is that the middle portion of the new alignment shown on the bottom screen there. We've divided those up into two different segments. Hamilton Construction is working on the one to the left there, or on the Dundee side, and the Newburgh side, Wildish, is working on those projects, or those construction work is proceeding well. We have had a landslide that is not behaving the way we actually had, so we're having to do a little more investigation around that, but it's not on the critical path of the project. Part of what we're doing when we build this segment is we're building it in a way that it's easily to expand from the two lanes to four lanes in the future, and that in that additional width areas where we're having a little problem. So it's not on the critical path, but it may eat into some of the savings that maybe we thought we were going to have on this project. The last piece of the project goes to bid early next year. It's the Springbrook piece that connects 219 back to 99W. That construction of that will be a two-season construction, completing in 2017, and when we'll be able to open up the entire piece. One of the things we're still working through for that last piece is the connection with Wilsonville Road and how that connects into the bypass. We've been working with the Neighborhood Association as well as City of Newburgh to work through that issue, but that has yet to be resolved. We continue to move forward with our contract. It's important for us to keep the momentum of this project moving forward from a construction standpoint, and so we keep our construction plans and schedule on track, but our communications with both the Neighborhood Association and Newburgh willing to adjust those through change orders as we go through and resolve issues of how Wilsonville Road will connect.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
And Paul, thanks very much for your work on this project. I had a great tour out there a few months back. What's the timeline, the anticipated completion date again? When can people expect to be using the bypass?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, the total completion of all the phases I just described will be 2 years from now, so in September, October of 17 is when we anticipate that. The two earlier segments, the one of the pictures I showed here, the Wildish and Hamilton work, what you saw out there in the tour, that'll be complete about a year from now. So we'll have that'll be done. That'll be done ahead of time.
Yes. And what's the I am continually confused a little bit because of the phasing of the project and the total budget number that's been both allocated and where we are in that budget. I think we're under budget on it, but do you have that information?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, I don't have the specific numbers, but we are projecting to be under budget with this. We're a little leery in saying an exact number since that big phase hasn't gone to bid yet. We'll know a lot more this spring when we open bids on that last piece of exactly where we are under budget. We'll know a little bit more about this landslide I just talked about, but we'll be under budget, and the question will be how much will be and then where we want to use that on the project. So once we know that this spring, we'll engage the community and what portions of the project might be the best use of that, whether it's proactively buying property again on this project for improvements to the north, the fish hook element on the south. We'll talk about where we want to focus those funds.
Thank you. And from ODOT's perspective, where are the discussions? In particular, I know that there's decision points with the city of Newburgh right now, that there was a design alternative that ODOT, and I want to thank you, for a couple years now we've been talking about it, and you've worked with the Neighborhood Association to try to come up with a design change for the east interchange with Wilsonville Road. But where's the decision point right now in ODOT's view on that piece?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, we've made a land use application to the city. It's been to the city council. They've referred it to the Planning Commission. Planning Commission is scheduled to take it up, I believe, in early November.
Okay, thank you. And to the committee, I would note that you have on your desk information that was presented to us today prepared by the Neighborhood Association for your perusal. Note that that's in your packet. Mr. Mann.
Good. There's just some more of the pictures of the work Wildish is doing as we kind of thread the needle between the town of Newburgh and the paper mill and the river. There's a large viaduct that's being constructed through the area. So the project, again, is going well. Woodburn Interchange, another one I've talked about a number of times. This will be the last time that I talk about it in my updates, and then we had a ribbon cutting. Yeah, we had a ribbon cutting.
Sure.
A very successful project. The city and the community is very thrilled with how everything has turned out. Here's a final picture of the interchange itself. You see we have a little more landscaping yet to do, but it's really a very, very nice looking project. This project has been done a year ahead of schedule. K&E Excavation out of Salem has done an outstanding job with this. This is another project that we have savings on. We are working to move savings from this project to two other JTA projects, one in Tillamook and one at the Kubler Interchange, to complete the scope that was originally intent with both of those projects. This is another view to show that's really more than just an interchange project. There are major improvements on 214, 219 as it goes through the community, and just a very nice overall improvement, a nice looking project. And a nice ribbon cutting event that we had about a month ago on the project.
Any questions?
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you. I just have more of a comment on that one. I think there's some behavioral changes we need to get on some of the drivers going to the factory outlets, because despite the beautiful new open exit that has multiple lanes, there is still a need apparently for some drivers to feel like they want to park on the right lane of the freeway instead of actually using the exit on that. But I'm hoping that as time goes by, folks will learn to use an exit.
Madam Chair,
is there a strategy for that, Mr. Mann?
Chair, Representative Davis, I noticed that on Labor Day, the back-to-school shopping rush, that we had traffic backed up for a significant way on the freeway. And it's not the interchange problem.
The
interchange is the work.
The interchange
is
working.
It's the parking lot. It's the whole infrastructure. So hopefully we'll develop some new habits. But, again, this interchange was designed not to solve every problem on every day. It's going to solve the problems on most days. But the day after Thanksgiving, those days like Labor Day, we're still going to see congestion at this interchange.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Pioneer Mountain, Eddyville, another project that I've talked about a number of times, and I've described the challenges that we've had with this project in the past. But it's had another successful summer in the work that we've done to continue to move this project forward. Again, this is a major project that's going to improve and shorten the distance between Corvallis and Newport. It's, again, that last piece of Highway 20 that needs major upgrades. And, of course, we saved the hardest piece for last, and it's proven to be very, very difficult. One of the things I'll talk about here in a minute while I got this map, if you look in the upper right corner right where my cursor is there, that connection where the new alignment connects back into the old alignment will be a focus for our work next summer as we finish this project, making that connection and then doing the final paving on the project will be the work that we have left to do next season. Here's some of the work. This is kind of on top of the project I described, kind of looking back towards Eddyville. Eddyville's in the valley there in the upper part of the picture. Some of the major fills that are really starting to take shape. If you go out there now, you can really see how the project is gonna work. There's one of the smaller fills, which is a very, very large fill, is actually complete here. This one's just about complete here. This is Crystal Creek. It has over 1 million yards of material in this fill, and it's just about complete. That's what it looked like about a week ago as they finish up putting the fills in place.
Cougar Creek. Where do you source all that fill?
What's that?
Where do you source all that?
Well, it comes from right there. So as a good highway engineer, we try to balance a project, and so your cuts and fills try to balance.
Pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
We balanced out pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. We have a little extra, so if you need some.
Okay.
Got a backyard right. Project going.
So this is one of the final cuts, but this is what the roadway is going to look like here just in a few weeks, where we'll have basically all the earthwork, the fills, and the cuts will be complete. We'll watch the project over the wintertime. That's been our approach with this, is to watch the instrumentation to make sure we don't have the slides doing something that we don't expect them to do. But we've had two or three successful years in a row, and again, knocking on wood, a year from now we'll be out there having a ribbon cutting in this project, and it'll be a very welcome improvement for the community of Newport and Corvallis in opening up this section of Highway 20. Last project, Highway 42 Curves project connects Roseburg and I-5 over to the port of Coos Bay, Coos Bay North Bend community. Most of Highway 42 have seen improvements over the years. This last segment right around the county line is, again, saving the hardest portion for last. The size of this project is only a $10 million project, so in terms of all the projects I just talked about, this is by far the smallest. But again, it's presenting some challenges for us. One of the slides in this area is not exactly behaving the way we thought it would. So we're going to be about a year behind schedule with this project. Budget, we should be okay with, in that we've had some contingencies to deal with the slides. But time-wise, we just want to take our time and make sure we've got the right improvement before we complete the project.
I appreciate that. That's been challenging for quite some time.
Yep, yep. Just another shot of some of the work. Neff Rivers, the contractor on this, has been great to work with. So a quick tour of the projects out there. Obviously, there's many, many more projects that we have going on. I thought I'd just hit a few highlights for you.
Yes, Representative Davis. Lively.
It's okay. Whatever. Paul, so the project that's not in here that I travel back and forth by quite a bit and a lot of people in Lane County do is in Highway 58 in the tunnel. And I know there was some unexpected things happened there, but I'd just like kind of an update on where that's at from a completion standpoint, because there's still delays in the traffic going across there.
Salt Creek.
This is Salt Creek Tunnel. Madam Chair, Representative Lively, I'm pleased to report yesterday we opened the project up from 24-hour flagging, so now it's open. And
really?
We have a little bit more work to do, but the next few weeks we'll be wrapping up that project and it will be complete. Perfect. There'll be a little bit of flagging going on during the day, kind of on an ad hoc basis, but that 24-hour flagging that we've seen all summer has ceased as of yesterday.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions on other projects? All right. Thank you, Mr. Mather. On to phase two.
Yes. So, if I can do this right. If I pull this off right, we're going to have a little technology to show you at the end of this, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed and I can pull that off or not. So transitioning to the next one, just talking to you about where we are in from a highway standpoint in preparation for a very large earthquake event that's forecast to happen off the Oregon coast. Very large earthquake, 9.0 earthquake, along with the tsunami that comes associated with that. I'm just going to give you a brief from a highway standpoint and the work that we've been doing from the Department of Transportation. I'll get into a little bit of the geology and a little bit of understanding the earthquake, but I'm far from an expert on many of the topics that this will touch into. And I'll try to stay focused on my area of expertise on highways and bridges and the work that we're doing. But I'm sure we'll have many questions. The one thing I will, before I get into this, the presentation, I would remind you or point out to you, tomorrow night, Oregon Public Broadcasting, Oregon Field Guide is going to have a special hour-long special on the major seismic event. I believe it's called Unprepared. We've been working with them over the last year. Some of the stuff that you'll see in my presentation, the technology I hope I get to, has been working with them to help communicate just where, how unprepared we are as a state for this major earthquake. And I think it'll provide a much deeper context than what I'm able to provide here today to you, of not just highways, but as a state, how unprepared we are for that. So I would highly recommend that you watch that tomorrow night or set your DVR. So major fault zone that lies off the Oregon coast. As you know, read the New Yorker article, which was a prominent kind of speaking point or point on this topic that came up this last summer, really has been a explanation point on something we've been talking about for a couple decades now. But the Cascade Subduction Zone really is, we're still understanding exactly how this works, but it really wasn't quote-unquote discovered until, say, around 1990, 1988, 92, somewhere in there. The pieces started to come together around really what we have lying off the Oregon coast and really what that means to Oregon. And so in terms of infrastructure, certainly when I talk about bridges that have design lives of 50 or 100 years, it's a relatively recent event and a kind of a game changer in how we look at and design our bridges and how we prepare our system to prepare for such a major, major event. And what you'll see in the TV show that I talked about earlier, they'll show contrast to what Japan went through a few years ago, Indonesia, Chile, other places around the Pacific Rim, and what that likely would look like here in the Pacific Northwest. So just from an impact area, obviously along the coast, not only will it be the ground shaking that will happen from the 9.0, but the tsunami that will follow that will have major devastation to the coastline. That shaking will obviously decrease as you move further east in the state. That earthquake, as some of the articles that I've read, will be felt as far away as Salt Lake City. So it's going to be a major, major event for not just the Pacific Northwest, but the western part of the United States. Some of the things that we've been working on as a state, we've been part of this. This is the Oregon Resilience Plan that was completed a few years ago. Work that was directed from the legislature, supported by the governor. One of the actions that the legislature took last session was one of the recommendations that was out of that was to create a position in the governor's office to be a lead on this. So the state resiliency office officer was a position that was created to help lead this effort for the state. This plan is comprehensive and just a strategic approach, kind of the 30,000-foot look at how are we as a state prepared and how do these pieces come together. One of the things that sticks out to me is obviously transportation is critical, but there's really three big pieces that come up over and over again that we as a state have to be prepared for: transportation, electricity, and fuel. Those three things come up over and over again and as a priority of where we need to use our resources to be prepared as a state. Here's a slide showing Oregon bridges and the damage that we expect or predict based on our models that we know to date. We will see bridge damage, landslide damage that will go east of the Cascades to Highway 97. But just as I showed you the map before, the concentration will obviously be on the coast and diminish as you go further to the east. Here's just some photographs.
Vice Chair Davis.
And Paul, thank you. Heading back to that last slide, can you talk just in general? That slide talks about the phases 1, 2, 3, and 4, and we see phase 1 with Highway 97. Can you just talk a little bit about, in terms of the critical transportation link between Washington and California, the staging and the phasing plan for addressing that issue?
If you bear with me, I'm going to get
okay.
to that.
And thank
I'll
you.
Get right to that point. And actually, when I get to some of the stuff I want to show you at the end, we'll come back to that point yet again. So I'll be
Perfect.
Talking about that a couple different times. But I just want to show you just some of the major kind of recognizable structures that people know about in the state. The Markham Bridge is one that we've done probably the most amount of retrofit on to the main span of that to make sure that it remains standing. But we will still see damage to that overall structure. If you just take a look at that picture for a minute and see all the structures that are in that picture, it's kind of mind-boggling to see of the need that you see and a major earthquake, the height of that structure, the ground shaking that's going to happen, and the potential damage that's there on that structure. Fremont is the same way. This picture doesn't illustrate all the approach spans, but the approach spans is where we would likely have the most damage on the Fremont Bridge. Ross Island is an older structure that we expect to have a complete collapse of, along with many of the other bridges, the older county bridges on the Willamette and Portland. Astoria Bridge, another one that will be collapsed. It'll now be from the ground shaking, but the tsunami. And it'll become a hazard, navigational hazard mm-hmm. in the river mm-hmm. Once it does go down that we'll have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Interstate Bridge is one that we've talked about a number of times in context of the CRC project, but again, a major link that will be in collapse. The 205 bridge is the newest of those of the bridges I've shown you. It was actually built in the early, middle 80s.
Representative Benz.
Excuse me for interrupting. What's the guess as to what will happen to the Columbia River dams and the Detroit Dam? Mm.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, so that's, again, outside of my area of expertise. But from what I've heard and read, that there are concerns with those as well. Exactly. I wouldn't be the one to describe to you exactly how they're going to perform.
Thank you.
Well, and the obvious result would be water moving two directions, which could be quite incredibly catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if the drought continues, we won't have to worry.
There you go. Good point.
A true optimist.
Although, if you think about Bonneville Dam, which was the first one on the main stem mm-hmm. from the 30s, it probably does have a lot of structural questions in terms of a major earthquake.
Yeah, I would make a comment that we have a bridge down in Coos Bay that was built in 1914, and the reason it has survived is because they so over-engineered things
yeah.
mm-hmm. in those early centuries because of the technology they had, that they way overbuilt everything. So I don't know if that.
Madam Chair, I'm going to come back to that point, too.
If that's true with dams.
Well, it's true of bridges. So I can,
true yeah, bridges,
so I can
yeah.
talk to you about the bridge portion of that, but I'll talk to you on another slide just about that very point.
Thank you.
So retrofit, the obvious solution that we have the technology. It's been proven in Japan, other countries, California, others have pioneered some technology of how we can retrofit our bridges. The national standard for retrofit is for life safety and prevent collapse. And California has used this standard to do seismic retrofit on their bridges, which works. I hate to use the word well, but works in a situation where you've got a major earthquake, but the radius of that earthquake damage may be only about 50 miles or so, mm-hmm. and you prevent the loss of life, for those bridges don't collapse, but then you have to go back and replace those bridges to use those long term, and you have then, you know what your needs are, and you can define those and finance those and so forth. But the scale that we're talking about in the Pacific Northwest isn't a 50-mile radius. It's a 500-mile radius. And we're going to need those bridges not only the day of, the day after, but for years after as we recover from this earthquake. And so we've moved to a standard of serviceability to make sure that the bridges, when we do the retrofits or our design standards, are to a standard that they're going to survive the quake and be usable for truck traffic afterwards, which is a departure from where most states are and the national standards are for design. So again, it's a relatively new piece of knowledge that we have around earthquakes, and kind of here's where we are with the status of where we are and doing some of the retrofit work. That phase one retrofit is basically just so the bridge doesn't fall down type of work. We have much more work to do to get that serviceability. The pace we're at with funding, it's going to take us 200 years to get to all the bridges that we have out there. The other key component of this,
Excuse me, Mr. Mather.
So are they, when you say they're retrofitted, does that take us all the way up to the 9 earthquake? I had heard someone say it took us to like a 7 or an 8, but not a 9.
Madam Chair, Representative, so it's not really in terms of numbers of the size of the earthquake. It's that serviceability. It's the difference between whether it's going to collapse or whether it's going to be functional is how we look at it as bridge engineers. And so a bridge will sit in a geographic area, and so we know the ground motions that are predicted for whether it's a quake in Klamath Falls or this major earthquake, and we'll use that in our design of the bridge. The question is, which standard do you use to design to? Do you design it to this prevent collapse, but then you have to go replace, or do you go to the higher level of its serviceability after the earthquake? I don't have the exact number, but the vast majority, we have very few bridges that are in the serviceability category. The new bridges that we've been building since the mid-90s, around 2000 is when we changed, I think, to this new standard. So the OTIA bridges, for example, the new bridges are built to the serviceability, but as you'll see in a slide later, it's a relatively small percentage of the overall bridges that we have in the state and in Western Oregon.
Thank you.
So the overall bridge needs, you've heard me talk about this. We talked about this as we were talking about potential new funding for transportation last spring, but we have a bridge conditions are in decline. So when you talk about going and doing retrofit on bridges, you need to have a bridge you can work with and do something with before you can do a retrofit. And so when we've looked at this, we're moving away, and I'll talk more about this later too, we're moving away from thinking about seismic in isolation. You've got to think about seismic as a total integrated piece of what that structure needs. It needs to be structurally sound before you can do some of the retrofitting work that I was describing earlier. Here's some of the demographics of bridges that we're talking about. And so if you look from a knowledge of the earthquake standpoint, around 1990, so these last three bars here are really the bridges that we're talking about have any kind of design feature based on known of the Cascadia earthquake. This is large bar here is the OTIA three bridges. Here are the bridges built earlier than that. So that's the vast majority of our bridges. Don't have the design features needed for the earthquake. So getting, Representative Davis, more to your question around some of our strategic approach to this and standing back and looking at our bridges, our landslides, what our overall needs, how are we going to approach this problem? What's the strategic lifeline routes? How do we minimize not only the loss of life the day of the earthquake, the weeks after, but the long-term economic effects of that? And at the same time, address our overall bridge needs that we have out there today. So again, coming back to that serviceability, the life support, so serviceability the day of the quake, the life support, what we're going to need in the 72 hours, the weeks afterwards, and then that long-term economic recovery and trying to keep the economy of Oregon afloat as we rebuild much of the infrastructure, not just highways, but much of the infrastructure throughout the state.
Yes, Representative McLean.
As you make that statement, the first thing that comes to my mind is when you give a 200-year, you know, scope as far as being able to do that work, there must be some priority process that you're going to be talking about. So, you know, when you're thinking about what do we need to do first and what is the most cost-effective, it always almost looks hopeless, right?
Yeah.
200 years worth of funding and we have all of this to do. So I'm just hoping that right from the very start, you guys have been talking about prioritizing and essential.
Yep, hang on a couple more slides. I'm getting there.
We will try and remain patient, Mr. Mather.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Here's a slide that will start to answer that question as well as Representative Davis's questions before. And so this is from 30,000 foot level, a statewide perspective, what are our priorities and how do we start addressing this? So it's kind of hard to pick out the different colors, but the blue color there is where we would start. And so a lot of people would think you'd start at the coast, where that's where you're going to have the most damage. Actually, our thinking is more of reverse of that. We got to start kind of where we have solid ground. It's like building a bridge. You've got to start on solid ground and then build up from there. And so where we see solid ground and providing that critical north-south route connection to other states, those lifelines that are going to help support us, is starting in that 97 corridor, then creating a couple links over to the valley, I-84, 58, and then I-5 through the valley. In the resiliency plan, one of the major focus from an air standpoint, the Redmond Airport is going to be a key piece from a response standpoint, from an air standpoint. So this also coordinates with the air response to a major quake by providing access to the Redmond Airport. Moving on to phase two, we complete I-5 there in the green and then make significant connections over to most, if not all, of the major communities on the coast, get connected with the green. The next two phases kind of fill in from there to provide some redundancy to the system. But you see there's many highways on here that aren't addressed. So many of our district highways, many of our secondary highways aren't addressed. This is just the major corridors. And when you hear us talk about our needs on seismic, we focus on just these routes. It's not all the bridges on the state highway system. It's just on these kind of critical links in our system. From a cost standpoint, we should divide up into these five phases, and we look at our total bridge needs, not just seismic, but also from a bridge condition standpoint, our landslide needs, we're talking about a $5 billion need. So what does it mean to the economy? So we ran this through our economic model and basically went through and broke the different links in there. So if you broke all these different highway links in our economic model, whether it's 101 or I-5 or Highway 58, and then you made some assumptions about how fast you would get those links back up, our assumptions are it would take us 5 years to get all the highways back working again. Obviously, we would prioritize and triage and get the major highways first, but it would be 5 years before we get everything from a highway standpoint back up and running. And so this map here describes from a heat standpoint, so the darker the red, whether it's a route or whether it's a region, the longer that highway or that region is going to be isolated in that five-year period. And what we forecast is about a $350 billion impact to Oregon's economy over a 10-year period, which will be obviously a major impact to the state's economy and our way of life. So looking from a cost-benefit standpoint, if we do just the first two phases that I just talked about, we will reduce that 350 by 10% or $35 billion. So a $2 billion investment gets you a $35 billion return in that investment. If you go to all five phases, we'll reduce that $350 billion by $84 billion. So for a $5 billion investment, while that's a lot of money, it's a significant return from an economic standpoint. You can just see that heat map just really get cooler and cooler as you go through the various stages and get those improved. Oregon, we're far behind our other states. Again, for a long time, we thought we lived in this sweet spot where there wasn't earthquakes. We had maybe the occasional one, a surface one. Maybe it's a one here in the valley or Klamath Falls or in the West Hills of Portland, occasional earthquake, but we didn't have the major quakes that Washington or California saw. And what we've learned is that's not true. And so it's put us behind the curve and where our neighboring states are in doing their retrofit work and their replacement work on their infrastructure. Some of the key findings that came out of the resilience plan, I think, that are kind of relevant for this group. So we need additional revenue, obviously, to address this. Their recommendations are to go pay-as-you-go, not in a bonding way, because we're going to learn more as we go through this. The third bullet there is on research. We need to continue to learn more about retrofitting, learn more about how the earthquake's going to behave, where the critical routes are. And then we need to move beyond highways. I've been talking about highways the whole time, but there's obviously the same needs that we see, whether it's transit, whether it's port, airports, the same assessment and strategies need to be put together that I just described here from a highway standpoint. We need to do the same thing for other modes and have a strategic plan ready for those. So this is most of this presentation is what we've been talking about at the department for about a year now and so forth. But as I think about some of the discussions and roundtables that I've been involved with over the summer, people's reaction to the New Yorker article, talking with people at the federal level and local level, here are just some takeaways that I would maybe have for you based on what I just presented. So one of the issues is engaging local communities. What I just described to you, I think, makes complete sense from a statewide standpoint, strategic, 30,000 foot, here's what, as a state, what we need. But if you live in any one of the communities, there's many things that you're going to say, wait a minute, what about my bridge that I need in my community? It's in phase five, it's in phase four. You're not going to get so a very good example is here in Salem. The bridges across the river are state bridges. They are in phase four of our plan. But if you live in Salem, you need to get to the hospital. You're going to need that bridge up and operating as part of your resilience plan, your strategic plan for your city. So what we need to do in our next step is have communities in Western Oregon. The coastal communities are largely there. It's more in moving to the west. We need to engage communities with our plan, saying, here's what we think we need to do. What do you think your plan is? And then make adjustments and tweaks back and forth as we maybe prioritize the five phases that I just talked about. And maybe a bridge over the Willamette and Albany makes maybe more sense to get to first, so we have a way of getting across the Willamette River. Those kind of discussions in different communities needs to happen. I talked about this before, but bridge condition. We got to stop talking about seismic separately and then bridge conditions as structurally. So when I report to you in our performance measures and so forth, I talk about how the condition of our bridges from a structural standpoint, from a functional standpoint, but then there's a seismic thing that's over here separately. We got to integrate those together. So when I talk to you about the condition of our structures, not only the structural components, but the seismic readiness of that's got to be kind of built into that measure. So we've got to do some work at the department and kind of relook at how we do our performance measures. And there's a federal component of that, too, and they prescribe to us how we measure our bridges that we've got to kind of sync up with that. But that's, I think, a key learning for me is we've got to stop talking about seismic as a separate piece that's all by itself. It's really integrated into the system, an important piece of the system. Then, obviously, funding. Funding is going to help a lot of things. It's going to help the condition of the bridges. It's going to help the seismic, as we, I think, talked about last spring in building different scenarios for funding packages. There's ways you can put more money into bridges and achieve multiple objectives and not have to set aside, again, money just for seismic. Mm-hmm. If you had money for bridges, we can do that in strategic ways that address multiple objectives and, again, stop thinking about seismic as a separate standalone piece.
May I interject a question? A couple of years ago when ODOT came to the Transportation Committee and did a similar briefing update, I brought up a conversation about the South Coast because that's what I know the best, and now I've learned an awful lot in the last couple of years. But one of the things for coastal communities that will be an issue is if/when these bridges go down, they do become impediments to navigation.
Right.
And using those what we call tidewater highways are ways we're going to move goods and services and people for some time until that infrastructure is rebuilt.
Right.
Does part of your planning include removing those obstructions to navigation when those bridges go down? Is that part of the planning process?
Madam Chair, we haven't got to that level of specificity. We have talked about having temporary bridges stockpiled strategically around the state to be used on especially our smaller crossings. Mm-hmm. But we haven't got to the level of detail where we talk about, say, the Astoria Bridge or the McCullough Bridge, about how we're going to get that out.
How you get out of the way.
Yeah, how do you get out of the way? Yeah. Yeah, we haven't got
we
to
have
that.
We have the capability to move things on. We've done it for a century, but that will become an impediment.
Yep.
So, okay. Thank you.
So, let's see how I do here. I wanted to show you a tool that we're working on. Hopefully I don't break this.
We hope you don't either.
Speaking of resiliency.
Yeah.
So here is a map that's showing that same view that I just talked about. We'll get all the bridges up here that are on that map. So here are the bridges that are on those. And it's a tool that we're developing, as you saw as I clicked through this, that we can do a number of different things with that has a seismic as well as bridge conditions. But you can zoom in on a particular bridge and see exactly where it is and what our forecast is for that bridge on those major routes. Again, this is not every single bridge, but it's on those strategic routes that I talked about. The value, I think, in this, and we were here last session talking about just bridge condition in general, and how do we communicate that? I think this is a tool that we're working on to help communicate the overall bridge problem. And so here is a map that shows where we have structural or functional obsolete bridges today. And you can go on here, and this is a tool that's still in development. We're going to put some more layers to this eventually. But you can do several things with this. So you can take off the functional obsolete. Here are the bridges today that structurally have an issue. But you can also go on here, and this is really the issue, is so in 2035, here are the ones we forecast to be having a structural issue. We can also use this to talk about that demographic problem that I was talking about before. So this shows you in a little more detail the age of our bridges and then the condition at the same time. So here are our older bridges, and obviously the redder colors, the oranger colors are the ones that are more deficient. And they're in parts of the system mostly where you would expect them in the system. They're older bridges on older highways that aren't as strategic. It's these bridges right here. These are the bridges that, as we forecast out over the next 10, 20 years, they're going to start looking like these bridges, and you got a whole bunch of them that are here. And then you have that design component that I talked about 1990. It's only these bridges in here, these being the OTIA 3 bridges, are the ones that were designed for seismic. And this starts to illustrate the problem, that kind of tidal wave, that baby boom generation of bridges that are headed towards retirement, or should be headed towards retirement, but we're going to ask them to stay in service for much longer. Anyway, so I just wanted to share that with you as a tool to help the communication piece as you talk with your stakeholders back home, and we start to help to illustrate the issue, not just with seismic, but overall bridge condition.
Vice Chair Gorsuch, and then Representative Benz.
Paul, I've noticed for a long time the picture that you showed with the strapping of the road deck to the bridge supports on the Markham Bridge. Has a similar sort of thing been done to the Fremont Bridge?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, I think so. I'd have to get back to you exactly on that. It's a different type of structure.
Right.
So its design elements are different, and so the retrofit strategy is going to look a little bit different. Where we are with our phasing in retrofit of the Fremont, I just don't know off the top of my head of where we're at.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Benz.
So I really like your last graphic reflection, but it's so bland. It's like the word resiliency. You have to kind of think about it for a while. And this is all joking aside. Is there some way you can hire somebody to jazz up those words? Because they don't communicate the right. True danger of the situation. And I went on the thesaurus here for a second to try to find something better. And apocalyptic bloodbath comes to mind, but not quite that aggressive. But
we got to be a little careful.
We do. But the point is, that's what you're trying to get across, isn't it?
Right.
This is a disaster in the offing, and those engineering terms are just too dry. How's that?
Yeah.
All joking aside.
Yeah.
Because what I do back in my district is go out and say, do you want all your little kids squashed by the roof on those buildings when this earthquake hits,
right?
Because that gets the point across. That's how do you,
Madam Chair, Representative, I think one thing we have found to be successful is, so we're the engineers, we're the technicians behind this, but we can find opportunities like you're going to see tomorrow night on the show that OPB is doing. We can inform people that are better at using those adjectives to describe and use visualizations and report on things in ways that better communicate to the public. We can provide that background information, and we've been working with OPB for the last year to support their program, and much of what I've talked about here and even this graphic you've seen in some of their communications to help illustrate and make some of those better illustrations of the problem that we have. And so as a department, we have some limitations, and we have just who we are limitations as engineers or technicians, but there are other avenues out there that we can engage with, and we have and will continue to engage with to help tell the story.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is very good information, Nat, and I just make a couple comments, because I spent the whole summer
since I chair the Emergency Preparedness Committee, going to presentations and stuff. And first, there's a lot of information besides.
Right.
And, Paul, I appreciate your emphasizing that this is not highways. It's electrical, it's trains, it's all of those things.
Right.
So we got to keep that in perspective. But there's a lot of information being developed that really helps us understand better what that all is. And this afternoon at my hearing, we're going to hear from the coastal communities and what they're preparing, because some of them have done some great work.
Yeah,
it doesn't solve the problem.
They've done some great
work. But they're doing some great work, and it's starting to happen to evaluate that. But the other thing I would just say is there is information available that helps describe the risk of the dams and all of those, and I saw a lot of that this summer. And what we need to keep in perspective is the risk. So what the percent of the risk is versus the breadth of this problem, and it goes back to the prioritization. That's why the prioritization becomes so important. Otherwise, it overwhelms all of us about how we're going to do it. But so if we compare the risk and where the highest risks are and even the percentage of risk, understand while we can all agree this is probably going to happen, it's still a relatively small risk in relationship to a lot of other things we have to address. Mm-hmm. But I just want to encourage, again, what the work they're doing and the presentation, and while I appreciate, Representative Benz, what you're saying about getting the message across, from my standpoint, the technical, all that information is critical to really understand and making the us making the decisions, because we're always not going to have enough resources to just take care of the problem. But it's great. There's a lot of other information out there, and we just need to spend the time understanding it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on that, so, I mean, I know that your purview is highway and bridge, but I assume that the emergency management people are also very much connected to what you're doing and what you're discussing.
I would actually describe it the other way. We're connected to what they're doing. They're
okay.
Really in the lead of the whole the resiliency plan, and we're following a lot of the overall direction.
Okay, and follow up.
Yes, sir.
And are they the ones then that would be responsible for trying to have certain repair assets, whether it's a portable bridge or maybe some other way of at least temporary mitigation? Is that where that lies?
That's our responsibility. I mean, where we put those and kind of the strategic coordination piece they'll help with, but it's our role to make sure that we've taken necessary steps to respond from a highway transportation standpoint.
So one more and then I'll stop. I've long thought, especially in the Portland metropolitan area, and the importance of, even though they're not highway bridges, the importance of the county bridges there,
mm-hmm.
and the loss probably of all of those bridges. And I just wonder if we've at least considered as a stopgap something like, a couple of ferry boats maybe stored at Swan Island that you could pull into service to kind of keep key routes open.
Madam Chair, that becomes challenging just from a maintenance standpoint.
Right.
They've got to be operational. People got to know how to run them. They've got to have fuel for them. So all the logistics of keeping even temporary structures in place that are still in the condition that they're usable,
right.
People know where they're at, they know what their limitations are, and if you think, rolling ahead 20 years and you have staff turnover completely, and
right.
So how do you manage all that to a way that it really is cost-effective? That's the challenge. The logistics is the challenge. Obviously, it makes sense to be prepared and have those things there, but what are all the logistics that support that so when you need them,
right.
You've got all the logistic pieces to make it make sense? I will point out also in the Portland area, you've got the new bridge, the Tillamook and Cross, the Orange Line crossing, that is going to be seismically fit to serve after the earthquake, the Selwood Bridge. So you're starting to see some bridges across the Willamette, even the Portland area, where you will be able to get across.
And John, Mr. Representative Lively, to follow up on your comment, and Paul, I mean, there are a plethora of professionals in the industry who have tugs and barges
and
fishing vessels and boats that they know how to run that are available. And I don't know if part of what you are working on is an
inventory
of what is already available that could be conscripted into service should they be needed.
Right. We do that today in that we have each one of our district offices know all the local contractors. So when we get a rainstorm, we get landslides, they know who they're calling, who's going to be out there, who's got what equipment available, all that stuff from a normal standpoint. We just got to do that in the context now of a seismic event that is huge, much, much larger than we're used to managing. It's not a flood. It's not a windstorm. It's not a snowstorm. It's much, much bigger than I think many of us can wrap our minds around.
We've got a whole bunch of folks out there that know how to
tribe votes. Representative McLean, then Vice Chair Davis.
I really appreciated the comment that you made about integrating seismic with what we need to think of as bridge readiness, bridge maintenance, and planning and actually delivering something that's going to work for our conditions as we know it now. And I think that's important, especially as we look for this balanced transportation package, because again, to Representative Lively and what I said before, for folks to think that we're putting money towards something that may not last or may not handle or may not work for or may not create the kind of connections we need to continue to have a vibrant economic ability, that's problematic. And I actually went to a citizen group to talk on something else and had them ask me, of course, about the transportation plan and package that we're trying to work on, and said, we want to suggest that you work toward raising the gas tax and other ways to make sure we have a system that's viable and usable. And they also mentioned the earthquake preparedness. So I think that we are getting some message out there, and whether it was a single article or whether it's awareness or whether the resiliency plan is out there now more and people are thinking about it, it doesn't matter how they got to where they are.
Right.
But we need to build on it.
Right.
And I think that we have to take your conversation today into the package transportation conversation, especially with it looks like citizens who get it are understanding and want us to keep going and not have this stop in our funding abilities or funding programs and those projects out there.
Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much, Paul. Your last comment leads nicely into my question about, you know who to call if there's a landslide, a major inclement event, you know the contractors locally. With this work that's been done, we may not need it for 15 years or 35 years or 75 years.
Yeah.
So what is the long-term strategy that the department has to say when that day hits and we don't know when it will hit, we know who to call and which shelf the plans are sitting on? What's the continuity, I guess, is the question. Because you're always on a daily basis, you're having to think about continuity about inclement weather, et cetera.
That's the exact challenge that I was trying to describe. If this is going to sit on the shelf for a number of years, and then the day comes, we've got to pull it off the shelf, and do we know how to use it, what it is, and how to use it?
Yeah.
One of the things that we're going to do, that we do, and we're going to have another exercise starting in a few weeks in the middle of October, is do annual exercises and test this. And so as you change out personnel and you change it, you've got these tabletop exercises that you go through and people are reminded of, oh, yeah, that's how we do that. And you learn as you go through them as well. It's like, well, wait a minute, we forgot about X, Y, or Z in this particular exercise, and we need to put that into our playbook and practice on that for the next time. And our coordination with our agencies, all those pieces, practice, I think is key once we figure out exactly what our strategies are and what our pieces are. And it's going to be a little bit of an iterative process. Yeah. We'll learn as we go, practice, learn more, practice.
Well, if you need legislators to join in and give you the practice of us calling you constantly during an emergency, saying what you're doing for our constituents, we would be happy to oblige. Or at least speaking for the whole committee, of course.
I was just asking Mr. Brennan if
you're not briefing afterwards. You're talking about being there present while they're
doing. I was just I'll just ask you directly. I was going to have Patrick contact you to see if observing a tabletop exercise for these committee members may be something that would be of interest, and if so, we could work it through our staff.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Any final comments? Representative Lively, I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Fascinating, just as Paul suggested, because there's so many pieces of it in that, and we're so far behind, but it's not hopeless.
That's right.
And we just got to get started.
That's
the key to bring hope. You've got to get started. Where we are now, we're not even started. We got to get something, some momentum moving in that direction.
That's right.
We don't need to solve it all today or even tomorrow or even in 10 years. We just got to get started.
Thank you so much time today. We appreciate it greatly.
Good. Thanks.
I just want to make note, I finally found my note here, so I have the title correctly in front of me. The report on the Governor's Oregon Trade and Logistics Initiative is the program that we moved to November, and it's a very important piece that I feel strongly that this committee, I think, needs to get a handle on.
We have an ag community that, because of issues that are going on at the Port of Portland, are having logistics issues. We have freight mobility issues. And we have a number of people who came together this summer in six different communities and had in-depth meetings about how we begin to get a solution to some of these logistics issues around particularly moving agricultural products. And part of it has to do with transload facilities, getting things from truck to rail. How do you move things out of the state to ports where they can actually get out in a timely manner? So I'm pleased that everyone has agreed to come together in November on this issue. When we originally planned it, we were trying to do a joint hearing with the Senate and the House Transportation Committees. It became problematic because Ways and Means was scheduled at the same time. Hopefully we have enough lead time now that we can work with the presiding officers to bring both committees together and have a robust joint informational hearing on this particular issue. So this may actually have been serendipitous and work out well for us now that we have a little more lead time to bring both committees together. Yeah. So we will look forward to informational days in September. Thank you for being here today. We appreciate your taking the time to sit in our committee. Any further comments? Mr. Brennan.
Madam Chair, so our next meeting will be, unless we reschedule for a joint meeting, our next meeting will be Wednesday, November 18th in the morning. I should mention also that the deadline for submitting bill drafting requests, this committee will have up to three requests that it can submit to council for drafting for introduction in 2016. The deadline for that is the following week, the 24th of November. So. So, yeah, just something for members to be thinking about.
All right. Duly noted. All right. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. And on that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all.